explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, we are about to learn more about who we are, and why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. This is Brooks Agnew, your host, coming to you from deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky. My AccuWindow forecast says it's about 82 degrees and partly sunny here. Don't know what it is where you are, but that's what it is here. The solar wind is a blustery 682.9 kilometers per second. Sunspot 953 has a beta-gamma magnetic field that harbors energy for M-class solar flares. So if you're planning a high-altitude flight, you might want to take some precautions there. It has a bright fringe above it to the north pole of the sun, which could be super-hot gases held aloft by these strong magnetic fields, or the crackling power of microsolar flares. We'll keep a close eye on it for you and let you know. Hey, don't forget to check out YouTube for the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We kind of cropped a 9-minute and 53-second version of our first leg of the documentary and put it out there for promotional purposes. We are currently in post-production with the 55-minute segment, which includes the discoveries we made in Tibet 2 weeks ago. So go to X Squared Radio and pick up the DVD now. You can also see the YouTube at our website at the BBS Radio Network. You'll be glad you did. It's a lot of fun. If you've seen any of the documentaries on the North Pole, I think you'll find this one interesting and entertaining. Also, we will be at Mount Shasta on the 9th of June to put on a workshop called The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel with Shalimar Productions. We'll bring you a commercial on that in our second hour. Check it out at our page on BBS Radio, our X Squared Radio. This is a 6-hour workshop that will change your life. If you can't make it, though, don't worry too much. You'll be able to view it via Streamlink live and as an archive for only $19.95. We're doing everything we can to get this information into your hands, so don't miss this opportunity. June 9th, Mount Shasta with Shalimar Productions. In the news, a 4.3 magnitude earthquake in southern England does not bode well for 1,000-year-old buildings. And this is rare indeed, and it plays into the predictions made in our first volume of The Arc of Millions of Years. If you haven't picked up your copy, second edition of Volume 1 has been out for a few months, and the second edition of Volume 2 is coming out in just about a week, so you'll want to pick that up. It's got the latest information in it. Volume 3 is about 3/4 of the way finished. We hope to have it out to you later on this summer. My friend Mark Pinkham is mounting 2 major events next year. Please click on the Templars banner at X Squared Radio, the Gnostic Templars banner, and register today. These 2 events may be the most important step toward world peace since the flood of Noah. So get involved, will you? Last week, we had 4 of the guests who will speak at the Earth Transformation Conference in Hawaii. If you are pondering whether to go or not, don't put it off any longer. Get your plane ticket, or if you live on the islands, get registered now. This convention is always great, but this year, I'm speaking on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. You really want to see this live, folks. If not for me, then go for yourselves. We'll have a great time and learn wonderful insights about the world today and what we can do to make it transform into a world of peace. Next week, we may have open lines. I have had tons of mail, so we decided to give you a chance to call in, tell your story. The following week, we will be in Hawaii at the convention, May 10th, and expect to run an archive that night. So call us up next week. We'll be here for you. And we're going to open the phone lines in the first hour tonight because we have a guest you may already know. He's been on Coast to Coast recently. He is a world-traveling author, an explorer of extraordinary phenomena. He has served as a counterintelligence specialist during the final years of the Cold War for the FBI and served as a special agent with the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, running counter-espionage operations. For the past 7 years, our guest has been a personal security and anti-terrorism consultant for corporate and private clients around the world. In addition, he founded the Lost Continent Library Publishing Company, a small press that specializes in classic adventure fiction, including his own works under the pseudonym E.A. Guest. Please welcome with us Walter Bosley. How are you tonight, Walter?
Good. How are you doing, Brooks?
I couldn't be better. I'm still getting over tender lungs from being almost 3 weeks at above 11,000 feet in Tibet, but other than that, I'm doing fine.
Yikes. I still envy you, though. I'd love to go there. I haven't made it there yet.
Well, I thought it would be a little bit more of a vacation than it was. I found that I was like, I kind of felt like those guys that climbed Everest. In fact, we met up with several of them that were going up to base camp, which is at 21,000 feet. We made it to 17,500 feet, and that was high enough for me. It took a long time for this body to get used to that altitude. It was a little worse on about a third of our group, though. Several of them laid out in the hotel for a few days.
Yeah.
And 4 days of dirt. 4 days of dirt roads doesn't help either.
Oh, no, not at all.
You know, we complain about our road building department here in this country, but you have not driven roads, rough roads, until you've been to Tibet and China.
Oh, sure. I've been in the vicinity of the at the edge of the Hindu Kush, and I know what that's like, even if you're in a town, but when you're out, and I know what you mean.
Well, even when you're in the town, the roads don't have lines. Mm-hmm. And so if there's no oncoming traffic, it immediately turns into one way going your way. And then as soon as oncoming traffic shows up, everybody crowds back into the left side of the road and lets it by. But somehow it's orderly. They have about, less than one death a day. While we were there, there were at least four fatalities and major public protests, because it was usually a bus that ran over a 100cc motorcycle.
Mm.
Not much competition there.
No, it's it's interesting, and there's many places where it takes me about 2 weeks, even if I've been there before, it takes me about 2 weeks to get used to the way they drive, and it's pure aggravation up until that point. And then I remember, and I get into the groove, and I remind myself, oh yes, this is right. So I start doing it the way they do it, and suddenly it all becomes smoother. And it does amaze
me. You don't actually try to drive in those environments, do you?
Oh, I have to. When I'm in a lot of the places, and what amazes me are the places I've been to with just the lack of logic in the traffic, and yet I've been on many, many trips where I've not seen one auto accident. So it works for them.
Oh, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. I've seen IMAX films of driving in Rome, and it seems kind of crazy until I sat in the left-hand side of a four-wheel drive going from the airport back to the hotel. It was like Keystone Cops on steroids.
Yes, absolutely.
Three-wheeled taxi cabs with 12 people in them, people sitting on each other's laps, and these things are darting in and out of traffic like they have 400 horsepower.
Yes. Yeah, well, it also is reminiscent in Africa and parts of the Far East, where they have the little called the tuk-tuks. You know, it's got a bicycle handlebar, it's three-wheeled, but it's motorized, and there's a little two-seater thing in the back, and the driver, as it were, sits on a little bike seat up front, in front of you. And these are tiny little things, and they just get out there and zip about in the traffic with SUVs and regular-sized cars, the whole thing. It's taking your life in your own hands.
Yeah, you really are. You really are. And we kind of went as quasi-tourists, so we had maybe some of the five-star comforts of a tourist, but we felt like we were on an expedition, because we went from, lap of luxury here in the United States to street life in areas with open sewers and smog. Never heard of smog devices there.
The concept of relativity takes on a new meaning when you travel the world.
Yeah, our guide said when we got to Bangkok, he said, now you might not think this is a five-star hotel now, but when we get back from Tibet, you're going to kiss the ground in front of this hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, he was right.
Mm-hmm.
I had never stayed a night in a hotel that had no heat and only had hot water between 9:30 and 11 o'clock at night.
Well, that's pretty good. You're lucky. Try having it, 30 minutes a day, or not at all.
Yeah.
I am a strong advocate of travel outside of the U.S. for any and all Americans. It's an educational experience, one to be enjoyed. Sometimes some aspects more so when you get back and reflect on it than when you're going through it. But it's something that, and some people say, "Oh, the world's too dangerous." The world is always dangerous. You could always die at any moment.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny. We went to the Swiss Red Cross we were visiting, and the Swiss manager who was there was talking about lens replacement and HIV education and all of this that they were taking care of. And he remarked about the winter and its lack of snow, and he made no hesitation whatsoever at blaming the warm winter on the habits of the U.S., and I just sort of bit my tongue and didn't say anything.
Right. Yeah.
And this from a country that uses rototillers and a wagon as a public vehicle.
Uh-huh. Well,
I was going to say, your travels around the world are nothing to laugh at. And you have noticed that along certain longitude and latitude areas of the world, certain patterns arise. And I found that fascinating in the chapter that you sent me.
Mm-hmm.
About the 33rd parallel around the world having some remarkable coincidences about it.
Well, it's, as many other researchers and writers have discussed before, talk about now in their works, there are many ancient sacred sites, a lot of documented mystical experiences, and tons of strange phenomena, including UFOs, reported with kind of a suspicious abundance in the zone between 30 and 40 degrees latitude north. And very
really, not just the north, not the south.
I have not studied the southern hemisphere yet. But the northern keeps me busy enough.
I reckon so.
Specifically, latitude 33, anything around 33, for instance, the Egyptian pyramids, the mysterious Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and many other sacred sites and mysterious ancient sites, but also certain events that, to bring it home with more resonance in the States here, for instance, the alleged Roswell crash of a UFO took place at 33.104 degrees. The JFK assassination in Dallas, of course, is at 32.78 degrees. And Disneyland, and it was kind of funny how we discovered this. I was doing a radio show with Greg Bishop, who is co-authoring this book with me. And we were on the show one night, and I had told the story that I'm going to tell you, your listeners today, about my interesting experience at Disneyland back in 1980. And we were talking about things about Disneyland, and one of them was Club 33. And, of course, everybody jumps to the Masonic explanation for Club 33. And I kind of wondered on the show, Greg and I wondered, let's take a look. So we looked it up, and we were just blown away. Sure enough, Disneyland is located at 33.8118 degrees. And it the whole thing about Club 33 and Disneyland on the whole took on a new meaning, as did my strange encounter with the old gentleman at Disneyland in Fantasyland in 1980. With Disneyland being located in this region, it was pointing to something very interesting indeed.
I wonder if the land in Anaheim, California, was purchased for the amusement park because it was on the 33rd parallel.
There is evidence for that. We go into that in the book, but Disneyland, as we discovered, and I was able to talk with someone in the public service office, the media office of SRI, the Stanford Research Institute. What we discovered was that SRI was consulted and their engineers hired to engineer and construct Disneyland, the original Disneyland in Anaheim. And yes, they did studies into the terrain and the geography. They did several locations in Southern California, and that location was specifically identified by SRI to Walt Disney as the place to put the park.
How about that? And
now,
just
SRI
because of freeway
was involved in, pardon?
And not just because of freeway access.
No. Some people, they point to the fact that part of the report was that they projected that there would be, you know, massive growth in Los Angeles area that would focus in the Anaheim area, and that's true, and that did happen. However, the interesting aspect of SRI's involvement is this is the company, the think tank, the engineering type firm that was involved with GPS systems, global positioning systems. Now, that kind of thing requires a great knowledge of many things connected with the Earth, the lay of the land, natural Earth energies, which would include the electromagnetic spectrum, which involves ley lines and all that. If anybody knew about these things in the Earth, SRI would be among them. And they, of course, were deep into this stuff back then. They strongly recommended that this site be selected for a variety of reasons, and it looks like that they would have known. Now, these are the guys. SRI, I would like to remind the listeners, is the organization also behind things like scientific remote viewing. So these guys are really into some pretty scientifically esoteric things. And so,
yeah, beyond time.
Yes.
Because remote viewing is not just, being able to see a remote place on the Earth, but also a remote time on the Earth.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, there have been a lot of battles fought along this parallel from, 1700 B.C. All the way to the first shots fired on Fort Sumter. That's a 33rd parallel, right?
I believe Fort Sumter does fall within that zone. A lot of things do. The Bermuda Triangle, you name it. Several areas where there's all sorts of strange phenomena, UFO, but also major human events. As you pointed to.
Well, Freemasonry, as you mentioned earlier, considers great significance to be part of the number 33. It's 33rd degree Mason. There's the number 33 is all through their lore,
right.
And it kind of has a morbid alignment. It's kind of a number of death or a transference from life to death. And interestingly enough, people may not know this, that Arizona's prison that has death row is built in Florence, and it's right on the 33rd parallel.
That's very interesting.
So, one other thing that people don't know, and I only know this because I did my postgraduate work at Oak Ridge, and I got to hold in my hands sand from the first nuclear test at White Sands, New Mexico. And that, too, is at the 33rd parallel.
There you go. There are many things. Some people say that, in fact, author Sesh Hari, author of Wonder of the Worlds and the upcoming nonfiction Handprint of Atlas, he really goes into this and that. But Sesh Hari, he points to the evidence and the theory that the very year that happened, 1947, is numerologically symbolic in itself. So you've got an event at the 33rd degree in 1947, and 19.47 geographically figures into both Earth and Mars. And it just, you know, on and on, the connections. But you mentioned the number 33 having a lot of passing from life to death symbolism. When you look at things electromagnetically, you're talking about polarities, and the whole life into death could also be just a symbol for an understanding of the electromagnetics of the Earth and polarities in themselves, instead of from life to death, going from the positive to the negative. And when you tie in the potential danger and hazard of this energy, it communicates something on a level that the diverse languages of the world might not be able to.
Yeah, I'm trying to... I'm limited on my knowledge of geomagnetism, that is to say the geological alignment of magnetic forces in the Earth, especially with respect to latitude 33. But it seems that the Earth itself does emanate some ELF, some extremely low frequencies, that resonate with the human mind. And it might be that along that parallel around the Earth is where a trough or a peak of the magnetic flux around the Earth reaches a certain point, a certain resonance, where masses of people are affected in pretty much the same way.
Yes, and they can, in those places... You can go to these areas and maybe go to some of these spots and kind of plug in, as it were, to this stream, and achieve a higher level of awareness, enlightenment. This is what hermeticism is about. This is what a lot of these things we're talking about are about. And this really is partially what I believe the device that Disneyland used to be. Was intended for, and that was to heighten a level of awareness and knowledge to those who would understand, or who could understand, or who are open to that sort of thing.
Yeah, now we'll cover this in a lot more detail in our second hour when we really talk about the symbolism and the animated design of Disneyland and why they chose the motifs that they did so that, anybody from school children to adults is at least going to be subliminally affected by this, but they're going to be made more open-minded to some of the non-fiction that goes with the fiction. But I'm particularly fascinated. I really want to cover it in as much depth as we can. What your observations are, and we could list trivia all day. Like, a lot of people don't know the Hiroshima, where the first atom bomb was dropped by the Enola Gay, is on the 33rd parallel. There's just event after event after event, and these are major warlike changes in the course of history. Not just the beginning of the Civil War, but the ending of World War II in Asia. Lots and lots of way more than coincidences, way more than any other parallel in history. This 33rd parallel is extremely profound. A lot of people don't know the no-fly zone established by Bush 41 across Iraq. The 33rd parallel.
Yes. You have to account also for the fact that it's in the temperate zones and where there happens to be large populations. People generally want to live where the weather is temperate and decent, except for folks who live in those cold places like the Great Lakes area and the north. I wonder, what are they thinking? But for the most part, you do have your large population. So certain political things, certain events are just going to happen in greater number because of the population. But this does not discount the strange activity, the extraordinary activity that occurs in this zone, and specifically at, you know, the particular latitude.
Well, it does, and yeah, you could, if you wanted to do statistics and say, okay, more people live on the 33rd parallel, or plus or minus 1 or 2 degrees of it, around the world than any other place on the planet. But I'm not sure in 1865 or 1947 that that was really the case. I think New York and London and Moscow and Mexico City, these were the most populous places on the planet, and they're not at the 33rd parallel.
And there you go. The historical evidence is some of the best. Before the mass populations or what population exists today was there, these things were going on. These things were being reported. Monuments were being, you know, built for their benefit. You're talking about, you know, history also that goes way back and an understanding of technology that goes way back before the conventional history that we're taught in school. The priesthood of academia in our world is going to chuckle and shake their head at these things. But
I like the way you put that. That's very well said. Sort of the religionists of science.
Yes. Oh, we have the priesthoods of academia, the priesthood of science. We have the priesthood of politics. You know, the priesthood is a concept that, you know, people usually just apply to religions, and those, that priesthood has been bad enough through history. Don't get me wrong. I have my faith and believe in things, but it's just an historical fact. And some of these very same people that are the guardians of the status quo, some of them, they know. They are aware of the knowledge of the past, the arcane secrets and such, and that's part of why they're suppressing this knowledge and the
wow.
The awareness.
You're mentioning going back before what we teach in our history and geology classes. Are you talking about Atlantis and Lemuria and these areas that also used to lay along the 33rd parallel?
Yes, I as far as Atlantis, I am at this point in my life, I am a proponent. I don't want to say believer, but a proponent of a term I actually learned from my friend David Hatcher Childress, and that is the Atlantean League. The Atlantean League concept is that yes, there was an ancient civilization that is lost. Well, apparently lost to us. That had the advanced technology. They did have a land that we now today call Atlantis, but they were global. They were colonial. They spread around the world. They brought their technology and their engineering all over the world, and the remnants, the evidences we know, are places like Teotihuacan and Tenochtitlan and these megalithic cities and structures that the farther you go back in dating them, the more advanced the technology in their building appears to be.
It's pretty remarkable.
Oh, it's absolutely. I do lectures sometimes, and recently I spoke before a group of young Mormon missionaries. And they were absolutely stunned and amazed at the images I showed them from a trip I took to South America, Peru and Bolivia, to the sites with the World Explorers Club, David Childress's group. And when they saw the precision of these stones, the way they were cut and placed, and when they saw the size of what they were just stunned. They were amazed. But the thing that amazed even me, and I've been all over the world. I've seen, you know, some of the classic sites. I've seen a lot of things, but there's one site that, if you're really into this or you really want to know, was there advanced technology in the past, at least engineering technology, I highly recommend you go to Teotihuacan at Lake Titicaca in Bolivia and visit the site called Pumapunku. There are blocks and stones. It's as if the city toppled, or was toppled. And what remains are these stones, which with precision cuts in them. Here's what I thought. I'm standing here looking at these blocks of stone, and what I'm thinking is, with my 21st century mind, I'm thinking this, for all the world, looks like a stone, or we would do it in cement, but a cement or stone foundation for some type of heavy machinery. For instance, a machinery like that which you'd find in a paper mill, something that just stays on the ground in one place, but it is no less a huge machine. Now, there's an example right there. I don't think most people, they drive by a mill, a paper mill, and they see big buildings and smokestacks, and they think inside there's a bunch of little machines. No, a paper-making machine is big. It's huge. And I'm not saying that, you know, this was a paper-making machine foundation. What I'm saying is, I'm comparing with my 21st century experience. This looked like something that was a foundation that a machinery could be fitted into and bolted down onto. Now, what's interesting is, I mentioned this to David, who was standing right there next to me when I was seeing this for the first time in 2003, and I said this to him. I said, this looks like something, and he kind of smiled a little bit, and then he told me, he goes, well, you know what the legend is? I'm like, no. And he goes, that this place was built in a day and a night by giants, and when it was threatened or was going to be destroyed, they knew it was going to be destroyed, they left. And in the legend it says they took their machinery with them. It looks like that. It looks like something that the machinery was unbolted and they took all the metal parts and the working parts and the whatever the item was with them and just left behind the stone foundation. Now there's also canal ways. You can see where the canal ways are. And what I find interesting is, for years, I'd been seeing where they always mentioned Teotihuacan and, you know, the megalithic stones, and you see the one square sun gate, and I never even heard of Pumapunku on any TV shows or in any books until I went on this trip, and I was just absolutely amazed that this was there, and I think that's an example of this civilization we're talking about when we say Atlantis and Lemuria. Somebody was on this Earth, and they had technology every bit as advanced as ours is today, if not more so in some cases.
I have to agree. I was myself sitting on top of the Temple of the Moon at Teotihuacan, which is sort of at the end of a mile and a half long street, and if you ever go there, it's 8,000 feet. It's quite a climb to get to the top of this.
At pyramid. Tenochtitlan in Mexico.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
It is quite amazing. And then when you talk to, well, we had an Aztec guide. We tried to find somebody who had Aztec roots, and he told us that the interesting thing is that the 250,000 or so people that lived in this city were not the ones that built it. They were actually driven by earthquakes and tempests from the
right
coast, and they migrated in mass over the mountains and down into this valley, and they walked up on this city all finished. And mind you, all these pyramids were coated in an organic white plaster, so they were alabaster white, the entire city, brand spanking new, sitting there, no art, no tools, no pottery, as if it was just built for them. And they walked in and literally just occupied it.
Yes. And that is the civilization that a conventional history professor will tell you was the civilization that built those pyramids, which is patently ridiculous.
It's not so. And you can even go and look at some of the paintings that they made when they first got there. Now, a lot of this was set on fire. As I said, the alabaster was organic, and during warfare, the stuff caught on fire and burned off of the volcanic stone that they built the base of the pyramids with. But they very clearly and repeatedly draw a rendition of a feathered giant who came there and taught them about creation.
Yes. Tenochtitlan is known as the city where men become gods.
Very fascinating.
I believe more specifically the city where men go to become gods.
Well, it was so until the Spaniards came and tried to teach them civilized religion and sort of looked at the scope of their architecture and at first said, you know, we don't have anything like this in Spain. This is way better than anything we have. So therefore, it must be of the devil and must be destroyed. And so most of it was.
Mm-hmm. You know,
in fact, when you go to... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to state a linguistic key to... linguistics is one of the big keys to these ancient civilizations that, or the ancient civilization that disappeared. And in Teotihuacan, in Bolivia, one thing I noticed was, you know, there's very similar descriptions, you know, of these city where men go to become gods, or the city of the gods, and in some cases, city of the giants, that kind of thing. But Teotihuacan is how it's pronounced. There's very much a possible connection to ancient Egypt or the Egyptian culture there in Teotihuacan. And it dawned on me while I was there, the Hermes Trismegistus had, of course, an Egyptian name spelled T-H-O-T-H. Many people pronounce this Thoth or Toth. But actually, the proper pronunciation is Tehoti. Now, you look at the name Tehoti, the great Egyptian genius credited with building the Great Pyramid, and you look at a city called Teotihuacan, well, pronounce it Teotihuacan, and you've got the city of Tehoti, or Tehuti.
Sounds remarkable, doesn't it?
Yes, and it stunned me, and I thought, well, if I can see this, I wonder who else has. But the bigger one question is, why hasn't anyone, followed through with that? Could there be a reason?
Yeah, well, since you went to Bolivia and you were sort of with an archaeological expert, did you learn of the Fuente Bull?
I don't recall. You know, David covers a lot when you're with him.
But the Fuente Bull is kind of unique in that it is covered with Sumerian cuneiform, which is not a language that originates in that area. We know where it originated, and it's about, well, according to local historians, it's about 2,000 years off timeline. It shouldn't be there.
Right.
It clearly indicates one of two things. Either the Sumerians traveled to Bolivia and left behind a bull, which I find to be highly unlikely, or the race or beings that taught the Sumerians cuneiform also taught certain leaders in the Bolivia area around Lake Titicaca the same language.
Well, you know, there is, for a while, there's been the theory that, the civilizing influence that, you know, humanity, civilization, however you want to put it, actually started here in the Americas and then spread out to the rest of the world. And when the explorers from the rest of the world started coming here, even in times before they're supposed to have, it was really them just returning to the original source of civilization. Again, conventional historians within their models that they've been taught will disagree with that.
Well, I think technology-wise, you have a point. But genetically, it does seem that they migrated the other way, that somewhere in around the areas in Iraq or Egypt is the origin of the genetic line, and they migrated out 2,500, 2,800 BC to the areas of Central America. Genetically, that's the way it seems. Technologically, it looks like it may have gone the other way. But if you assume that all of the technology originated here on this planet.
Well,
but
it's true.
You know, if you toss in the intervention theory, where others came from outside and traveled around and taught various civilizations the technology, then both theories fit kind of nicely together.
However, there is the issue that somewhere between 9,000 to 12,000 years ago, there was a cataclysmic disaster that caused many things. One of them, most cultures seem to agree, was a worldwide flood. And this very much was like wiping a chalkboard clean of what was there before, so that these races that look like they originated in the Far East, the Middle East, or whatever, that just might have been where they ended up, and recorded history started all over again.
That's where they re-originated from.
Exactly. They could have originally started, here in the Americas. And then you've got the fact that the Egyptians are considered a red race. And, what we call, natives of the Americas are considered, very often a red race, things like that. Who's to say? But it's...
I'll tell you what I saw in Tibet, and I photographed several hundred people, nuns and monks and people that have never left Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
I saw American Indians. That's what I saw.
Isn't that interesting? There's a gentleman...
Same facial features, same red skin, same lack of facial and body hair. I mean, these people were American Indians, no question about it.
I don't know if you're familiar or listeners are familiar with this particular book, and I apologize, I can't remember the author's name at the moment, but it's a thin book called The Last Book on Atlantis You'll Ever Need. And
I haven't read it.
Oh, I highly recommend it. The author has done some great research and shows linguistically, and what you mentioned about, the Tibetans look like American Indians, but he shows linguistically that Hindu explorers, ancient, we're talking in the days of the Mahabharata and all that, came to the Americas, and he points out the linguistic similarities between Native American language and Hindu terms, ancient Indian terms.
Really?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic book. My first copy I left on an airplane flight flying over the Hindu Kush, actually. And I bought another one just because it was such a great book, and I didn't want to lose it. And but I don't have it at hand here, otherwise I would give the author's name. But I believe it's titled The Last Book on Atlantis That You'll Ever Need, and it is available in the Adventures Unlimited Press catalog. Talks about this.
Well, we want. Are you featuring that book on your website?
No, I do fiction. Yes, I do fiction, and we will be, we sell printed books, we sell electronic books and a magazine and stuff, but I am considering a new imprint that will offer nonfiction works that are kind of along these lines of the ancient world and such, because it fits with the fiction that we do. Naturally, in the guidelines for our fiction, I highly encourage the authors to delve into these ancient subjects. We like to see this in our, I put it in my own writings. If when you read my own writings, and I write very, as E.A. Guest, I write very intense fiction for mature readers. My stuff is not for kids, but as far as the... these things we're talking about, these ancient mysteries and stuff, that my books are just full of that, and I encourage that with our authors. But we are thinking about a nonfiction imprint.
Well, sounds absolutely fascinating. Now, you have a website. Why don't you go ahead and give that to us now?
Okay, that's lostcontinentlibrary.com. lostcontinentlibrary.com. And we also have wonderoftheworlds.com, and that's the page that focuses on our biggest book yet by Sesha Ree, which is about Nikola Tesla, Mark Twain, and Harry Houdini on a journey to Mars in 1893. He's going to be featured in UFO magazine. Sean Castile just did a big interview with him, and he's been appearing.
One of my favorite magazines. I run an ad in that magazine myself each month. Met the editors, very sharp people, took a big risk starting that magazine. And they've learned a lot about publishing magazines. And in that genre, it is, people think that, 68% of just about every population in the country believes in UFOs. But as far as an economic powerhouse for supporting a major publication, it is not. But we're trying to help them grow.
Sure.
You mentioned Nikola Tesla, and I definitely want to cover that a little bit in the next hour because, as a physicist, I kind of look for patterns and for symbolisms in other cultures. And when I went to Tibet, I absolutely had my mind blown. I took a movie camera, I took a digital camera, I took a film camera, and then the crew that went with me also had digital cameras, and we took about 10,000 photographs in 19 days.
Wow.
But the interesting thing was this amazing way that they bury Dalai Lamas and Panchen Lamas in a structure they call a stupa.
Yes.
Now, very similar considerations about the travel of the soul from this dimension or this world into another world, similar to Egyptians. But the construction of this building and it doesn't appear to be. It is a replica of a Tesla coil, only the darn thing is 70 feet tall, and it's made with over 4,300 pounds of gold. And the replicas or copies of this from the fifth Dalai Lama on to today, all the way to literally 1989 when the last one was built, they're all the same. There's no precursor, there's no change, there's no evolution, there's nothing, and then there's the stupa. And the the symbolisms on it are completely mind-blowing. And they put these sometimes inside buildings so that they could put a flat ceiling above it, and then on the flat ceiling, directly centered over the burial arch where the actual mummy is put in, directly over that is a four-dimensional stargate in mandala form put on the ceiling. I mean, they make no bones about it what this is used for.
Now, what effect does this have on the mummy within?
Well, they don't really know. It's sort of like they're copying it. They don't really understand where it came from. The Tibetan language wasn't even formed until the fifth Dalai Lama, the sixth Dalai Lama, put the Tibetan language together. Tibetan Buddhism didn't even exist until the sixth Dalai Lama. It was just sort of a mishmash of ideas, and that Tibetan Buddhism is an amalgamation of 9 different cultures that he did on purpose, and so he's considered the father of Tibetan Buddhism, and that's 7th century stuff there. But here is this structure that's just amazing, and it's the proportions. There's over 10,000 jewels on it, and I look at it, and I did an internet search that night, went to an internet parlor, and pulled up a Tesla coil, and I showed the crew. I said, you see, this is the coil that Tesla built. Now tell me that's not a stupa. Only Tesla didn't build his until 1899. So a little bit difference in time there, but somebody understood something. Now, I don't think it's a functioning Tesla coil, but I think they saw one work.
Yes.
And
they thought
they copied
that it would maybe bring their leader back to life, perhaps.
Yeah, or at least transport him to a place where he could reincarnate and come back, because that is a big, big part of Tibetan Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Sort of like the pyramids with Egypt are. You settle your carcass down in the sarcophagus, and even a live person has something nigh unto an ascension experience. Whether you're a believer or not, you're going to feel something by laying down in that because of the way it concentrates earth energies and refocuses them on that sarcophagus. You
right.
have dreams. You have out-of-body experiences, that are part of this initiation process of an Egyptian priest.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you read the works of Joseph Farrell, the Giza Death Star series, you see how powerful the Great Pyramid was as a machine, whatever it was. And it doesn't surprise me that that power still, to some degree, still resonates to this day. So it makes a lot of sense that, you know, you lay down in the so-called sarcophagus and that you would still get something out of that. It's massive. It's a huge pyramid. And as we know, with experiments with pyramids, interesting
wow.
things occur.
I wonder if Sarajevo in Bosnia, just north of Bosnia, if that's on the 33rd parallel as well.
I can, you know what, I'll look that up on the commercial break. I've been there several times, so I would be I'd find that very interesting if it is.
Do you know Sam Osmanagic?
Nope.
He's the guy. He's the archaeologist that exhumed the Bosnian pyramids.
Yes, okay.
And as soon as the snow melts off, in a couple of weeks, he's going to be back there. And I've been invited to go out and interview him on site. And I'm definitely going to make the trip.
Oh, good for you. The trout there is great, by the way.
Well, I love trout. Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, speaking of commercial breaks, let's see. I need to make sure that I pull up the right one here. We are kind of a small outfit here at X Squared Radio. I kind of wear several hats, but that's the way it goes, and we try to bring a quality show to you. This is X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is Walter Bosley, and we're talking about the 33rd parallel and getting ready to talk about the remarkable symbolism and coincidences at Disneyland. So don't go away. We'll be right back with more of X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you, this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and here the results are always positive. I want to make sure you know about the upcoming events. So please go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and make sure you sign up for one or all of the speaking events this summer. Of course, you can go to events in Hawaii, Mount Shasta, Trout Lake, Washington, and even San Francisco. My workshop with Shalimar Productions is 6 hours long. It's entitled The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And this will be in Mount Shasta, June 9th. The cost is just $77 plus registration, or you can watch it live from home with Streamlink. And you'll be able to go to the websites and find out how to register for that live broadcast. We're trying to do everything we can to make sure to make it convenient for you so you can get this information in your hands. Now, that happens June 9th. But we need you to sign up now. The folks who are taking the risk to bring you these events need your support. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the commercial that we just had, the Nitro Pack commercial. They are running some spring specials right now, so you will probably want to go to Nitro Pack banner at X Squared Radio. Make sure to click on that. Everything you need for survival, and we're talking backpacks, battery-free flashlights, food supplies, water filters, all kinds of dehydrated food. It's packaged well. Trust me, I researched companies for almost 5 months until I found one that was worthy of you and worthy of this broadcast. They have been in business now over 18 years, and they really deliver a quality product. And I can't stress upon you enough how the difference between life and death, or survival and not survival, can be if you just have a few simple things around the house that will last for 20, 25 years without even touching them. When you need them, they'll be there. Our guest is Walter Bosley. He is currently writing a book with a co-author. It is, I've got two sample chapters, the first of which we went over, talking about the amazing things surrounding the 33rd parallel. Now, there have been a few books written on this, but I have a feeling that Walter and his co-author are going to pull this together in a way that's not only informative, but also entertaining, not just a bunch of trivia. And speaking of trivia, I think Walter was going to look up if Bosnia was on the 33rd parallel or not during the break. Did you get that done?
I found that it was, from what I saw, my source said it was on 43. However, there it is within the zone of the 40. Remember, we're talking about a band around the Earth at between 30 and 40, and anything kind of within the vicinity of those two. And for my money, 43 is close enough.
That's pretty close. Well, according to Sam Osvanogic, these are the biggest pyramids in the world. A lot of people poo-pooed him and said that he was just trying to do some profiteering until late last fall he finally broke through into a chamber on the inside of one of the pyramids, and there were the smooth, polished walls and glyphs along the walls. And now they're excavating like mad, trying to get this pyramid out. And the funny thing is historians were saying that these were all, you know, Stone Age, Bronze Age nomads, travelers, that there was no organized society living in that area.
Yeah.
But boy, they really missed the boat on this one.
Well, it's, you know, the idea of diffusionism, the idea of advanced technological races in the past, this skirts the edge of being politically incorrect these days. There are actually people who believe, and this has been the prevailing thought for years, that when you say an advanced civilization came from somewhere else, or ambassadors or representatives, members of an advanced civilization came from somewhere else and taught any of the locals anything, they call you a racist. They say, oh, well, you're a racist against the people that, you know, were there. simply because, you know, you point to the evidence that it wasn't made by the locals, it was made and left behind by someone else. And this is just another way to, really, it's another way to silence people from talking about things like this. It's a way to silence, you know, people like the professor over there in Bosnia from pointing out the truth. Because, you know, if you're called politically incorrect, if you're called racist, then, you know, you drop it like a hot potato if you care about your reputation in the status quo, or in the mainstream, I should say.
Now, fortunately, we don't take scientists out and burn them at the stake these days, but peer review, and a bad peer review, is just about like being burned at the stake. And I think all Sam's really trying to get the world to do is come and look through the eyepiece, kind of like Galileo did with the church. Look, I've built this really neat telescope, and I think I can prove to the most casual observer that the planets and the Earth actually revolve around the sun and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you don't want to be the first newspaper that publishes the headline, Earth Discovered to Be Round.
Right. It's, you know, And it's understandable. It's a very human thing that when you've got your comfort zone, you want to stay in it. That's very natural. That's a human thing. However, ultimately, staying in one's comfort zone isn't necessarily the best thing for your growth and your advancement.
Well, we've seen a lot of societies do that to their demise. And I gotta say, I was raised in Southern California, and I've been to Disneyland about as often as I've been, or more often than I've been, to anything else entertaining in my life. I've probably been to Disneyland 30 times.
Right.
And I mean, when we get in there, we know which rides to run to because the line is going to be so long. You're only going to get to ride it once if you don't.
Right.
But you had an amazing experience as a youth in Disneyland in 1980.
Yes,
can you
I
tell
did.
Us about that experience?
Well, you will recall the days when you could go to Disneyland, say, on a Wednesday in February, and my goodness, you would walk from in some of the back walk areas and maybe see one or two people after 6 p.m., after, you know, 6 or 7 p.m.
Oh, sure. You could ride the Matterhorn and then run to Magic Kingdom, and you could ride It's a Small World, and you could just go on and on and on.
Yeah, and this was this happened in those days, 1980, and I was there with I was there with some friends. I was in high school at the time, and there with friends, and we got into the evening, and I think the park was going to close at 10 or 11. I can't remember exactly which. I believe it was 11. And about 9 o'clock in the evening, my friends and I went to ride the carousel. I'm one of those who I ride anything in there. There's very little that I won't ride even to this day. It's part of the experience. You'll even see me on the little Winnie the Pooh ride that they put in Bear Country. What the heck? It's Disneyland. It's a ride. I paid my money. I'm going to, you know, get the whole experience. So there we were on the carousel about 9 p.m., and it was a Wednesday. Those of you who are familiar with the statistical lore of Wednesdays and strange phenomena, particularly Wednesdays in the evening time around 9 p.m., which I learned about years later, by the way, you'll know that that's a flag right there. So we're on the carousel, and as we're spinning around, in that area that is the pathway from Fantasyland to the back of Tomorrowland where the Matterhorn is, that's in between Mr. Toad's Wild Ride and where Dumbo is, where actually it goes along the storybook land boats there, I saw an older gentleman standing there watching the carousel go by. Now, this man had white hair and a white beard. He was a Caucasian. He was wearing a black suit coat and pants and a white shirt. I seem to recall him having a vest. And I placed him about 70 years old. As we go around, there he is every time. Finally, when we get off the carousel, he's not there. But we continue on that pathway I described from the carousel back towards the Matterhorn. And there on a bench in the vicinity of the Matterhorn was this man. And, you know, it struck me as we passed around him on the carousel, he just had this look in his eyes like he was amazed, he was astonished. And sitting there on the bench, he was like a man in a daze almost, just kind of looking around him. You know, not drunk, not, you know, anything like that, not incoherent. This was a lucid, you know, intelligent man, but just like he was there for the first time and had never seen a place like this is what it is, what it was. And I felt compelled, and this is an important part of this, I felt compelled to approach him, and I had two friends with me. We went to the bench and, you know, just started chatting a little bit. Hi, how you doing? Are you having a good time? And you know, is this your first time here and such? And he said, yes, it was his first visit there. Now, this was in the days when they had the ticket books, A through E, but they also had the passport ticket. And I had started to buy the passport ticket about that year. So I had a passport ticket, and you still had to show it to get on the rides. Today, you don't have to show it once you're in, but in those days, you had to show the passport, so it was easier just to actually pin the ticket to your shirt. Sounds like you're in kindergarten, but it was, you know, functional. So, I had this Donald Duck pin, and the thing was pinned to my shirt, so I'd be hands-free, as it were. And this man told us that he had, you know, run out of all but, I think, an A ticket, whatever ticket that you could get on some of the slower rides. And it was his first trip there. He'd never been there. The odd thing is I don't recall if he had an accent or not, and this comes into play later in the story. But I decided that we should go ride It's a Small World with this gentleman. Said, hey, let's go over here to Small World. Let's ride this. Come on, let's go over here. Because it was almost as if he wasn't sure what to do. And so we get on, It's a Small World, and I ride up front with him, and my two friends are in the back, and he's just we're going through the ride, and he's just looking at everything, just amazed. And we get off the ride. He tells me his name is Alfred, okay? Name's Alfred, and this is his first trip there. We get off the ride, we head back to where we were, and, you know, I look at my watch and I realize, you know, it's about 9:30. The park's going to close in an hour and a half. I grew up coming to this place. I'm going to be coming back again. You know, I just felt, you know, something in me said, give the old guy your ticket. So I unpinned my passport and I pinned it to his lapel on his jacket and told him he could get on any ride in the park with that. He still had an hour and a half. He could get on anything and everything with that. And his face just lit up. He was just very grateful and thanked me profusely and was excited, almost like a child. And, you know, he said, thank you. And we said our goodbyes and parted company. My friends and I went towards Tomorrowland, and he went back into Fantasyland. And that was the last I saw of him there at Disneyland. And, you know, I went away with, you know, the warm fuzzy, you know, okay, I did something nice for, you know, an old guy. And there we go. What is there to think of that? Well, through the years, as I learned things and experienced more things, I began to wonder just what was this experience I'd had with this old gentleman, 70-year-old white-haired gentleman in the black suit named Alfred. You know, what did this mean? And it was in 1992. I'm in Manhattan working for the FBI, and on my lunch break, I go to the, I don't know if it's still there anymore, but there used to be a bookstore called the Coliseum in Midtown. And by 92, some things had been happening in my life. Now, I have to say, I didn't go into this, but in December of 1979, okay, just a couple of months before I met Alfred at Disneyland, I experienced what I consider the most significant event of my life. I had gone to bed on a Saturday night in December of 1979, one person, and I woke up the person I am today, essentially. That in itself is a story, but I just need to mention that it was an enlightenment experience. And then a couple months later, I have my encounter with Alfred. Now, I was, you know, by 1992, some other things that happened that I talk about in the book, that I go into detail these things in the first chapter of the book, first or second chapter. And so it still stuck in my mind, you know, what was this, out of all these weird things that have happened to me over the course of the last 12 years, you know, what was this about? What was this experience at Disneyland? There's something to this. So there I am in 92 in the Coliseum bookstore, and I pick up a book on ley lines, which I had just vaguely been aware of in the late 80s, and about 1987. I pick up this book, and it's called The Old Straight Track. And I notice the author's name is Alfred Watkins.
Really?
The book's written in 1929, and Alfred Watkins was from England. And I turn the page, and I look inside, and I am shocked because there is a photo of a man about 70 years old, white hair and a white beard, even wearing a dark suit, and he is the spitting image of the Alfred I met at Disneyland in 1980.
How about that?
Yeah. That's what I said in so many words. But even then, I wasn't sure just exactly what to think of that until last year when, you know, there we were in 2006, and then all the things I've learned and experienced just since 92 and became a lot more versed in the things that I didn't even notice about that night in 1980. But what really sparked it was talking with Greg and discovering that Disneyland is indeed at latitude 33. And when I began to really delve into things, that astonished me, and I realized, okay, something very specific happened to me, and it has to do with something geophysical at Disneyland. And the book, of course, goes into what that is and what's involved with it, things at Disneyland that, unless you're aware, you don't notice.
Well, I'm flabbergasted. Not flabbergasted, I'm amazed, and I'm don't know where to begin. So what I want to really do, because I can't let it go by, such a statement like I went to bed to one person and I woke up the person I am today, mm-hmm. I want to know a little bit more about what went on that evening in December of 1979.
I seem to recall it was a fairly typical evening in our household. My parents were still married. They got divorced, oddly enough, the next spring. I certain things pop up when I say that, and I have my opinions on that. But regarding, some people would say, oh, you were just going through an emotional time. I have to tell you that when my parents split up the following spring, I did not see it coming. There was really nothing overt. So I did not grow up in this troubled childhood. It was quite the contrary. So the picture that I need to paint for you on the Saturday night in December of 79 that this happened was typical. Family, you know, sitting in the living room watching the usual TV shows we would watch on Saturday nights. Back then it was, It was Love Boat and Fantasy Island, and before that, I think Baba Black Sheep. I mean, I remember that.
I think
stuff.
We used to watch Gunsmoke.
Yeah, that was the era that we're talking about. And, you know, I was a kid who built Star Trek models, and, you know, I was into Edgar Rice Burroughs. I was into Planet of the Apes, you know, the typical stuff. You know, it was nothing traumatic happened. It was extremely mundane and typical. There was nothing. The only thing that I could even point to shortly before that I went through was our last family vacation in that summer. Among the things we did on a trip up and down the California coast was go to SeaWorld, and I had kind of an epiphanic, some type of weird moment in an old show that they used to have there where they would have these divers in different colors doing this ballet underwater. And I had this, you know, this little weird moment where I felt something was communicating to me. But, that was a very brief thing. But there we are in December. I go to bed on this particular Saturday night in December, and I wake up. I open my eyes Sunday morning, and the first thing I do, now I'm just 16. I had turned 16 a couple of months before, so that's how old I was. The first thing I did, I opened my eyes, and I lifted my hands to my face, and I looked at them. I just held both my hands up, and I really looked at my palms, and I was seeing detail that I had never really noticed before. Or it was like, you know, I was looking at them for the first time, but my thought in my head was, these are not my hands.
Uh-huh.
This was my thought. These are not my hands. And I'm looking at them, and then I turn and I look at the wall, and I'm looking at the texture of the wall. I get out of bed, and I start walking through the house, and it's probably, 8 or 9 in the morning. I walk through the house, and it seems more three-dimensional. I see my mom in the kitchen, and my thought is, okay, there's mom. She's not my mother, but she's mom, as if it's a role or a character. And I, you know, there's sisters, Beth, Tammy, but they're not my sisters, and on and so forth through the house. And that night, I remember, it was kind of funny. I don't know if you remember the old comedy show called Soap, where the one character, Bert, kind of goes nuts and thinks he's invisible. And he would sit in the room and go, oh, no one can see me. I kind of chuckle about that, because that night of the day this happened, I'm sitting there in the living room, and they're all watching TV, my sisters, my mom and dad. My sisters had a couple of friends over, and I'm sitting there just looking around this room going, okay,
they
all
don't
right.
see me.
What's that?
They don't see me.
Well, no, I knew they saw me. I wasn't invisible, but I felt like I was somebody else.
I know this feeling.
Yes, and here's another interesting aspect about it. This was when, overtly, I started having strange psychic experiences. I was a kid who, I grew up on horror films. I love horror films to this day. I just love them. Absolutely love them. It's great cinema. It's good fun. I love the stuff. But because of that, I was a kid who, I'd never walk into a dark room. I'd reach in and turn that light on first. Well, after this experience, I found myself walking into the dark room and then turning the light on. I wasn't scared anymore. It was incredible. Those who have been through it know what I'm talking about. Those who haven't, I couldn't possibly explain to you. But I, the person I am today, is that person who woke up that morning. Okay, not the person who went to bed that night. The memories before that are interestingly disconnected from emotion. It's more like they're files in the brain that I can pull up and look at them vividly. Yeah, here's my 5-year-old memory. Yeah, here's my 12-year-old memory. But it's more like they're just files in a brain, you know, in a computer that I can pull up and say, okay, yeah. So that happened to me just a couple of months before this trip to Disneyland.
Well, I'm trying to figure out where to start with this, because I'm going to ask a question, and I don't know what the answer is. So it's that's a strange question to ask for a talk show host. Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried to go back and find out what went on that night while you were asleep? Did you try to understand if there was some kind of download or some kind of ascension experience or something that you had in your sleep that your conscious, your subconscious mind went through, and then when you, I'm going to say, when you awakened in a literal sense the next morning, you had a deeper connection with your subconscious and realized much more awareness than you ever had before? So how did you ever try to go back and find out what went on that night?
Yes, I did. I went to a gentleman at I went to a shop that's in Torrance, California, called the Psychic Eye. Now, I got to tell you, I enjoy going to psychics. I believe there are people with psychic powers and stuff, but I don't give anything to psychics I pay money to. And what I mean by that is their job is to tell me. And that's how I've rated the ones that I feel are the real deal and the ones that are charlatans. I sit down, I've given you my money, start talking. I'm not going to tell you everything for you to then put together some ridiculous, vague thing that you think I'm going to go away, you know, amazed. But I went to this gentleman, and he does regressions. Now, because of my professional background, I was very reluctant to do a regression. My concern was, and I asked him, is this something like, I'd have to be concerned about either blurting out something I shouldn't or somebody probing me for areas I shouldn't. And he explained to me that's not how it works. If there's something I'm not supposed to talk about, I won't, whether I'm under hypnosis or not, at least on the level that he works with. So I decided to do a try regression. And we got to a point where I ended up, the image in my mind's eye was a face that was kind of unclear. But it was blocked. He told me, he goes, it's blocked, you're blocked. There's some block in place. And that wasn't the first time I had been told that. But I went back to the shop, and he had gone, but a new one had replaced him. A really good lady by the name of Deborah Savitt, who used to be out in Palm Springs and in L.A., but now I believe she's in New York. And I tried through her, and she got the same thing. There was a block. So those are the attempts I have made through, you know, working with psychics to try and take me back, regress me to that night, but to no avail. However, here's an interesting thing that along the lines of my trying to put this all together. I have a mentor in life. This gentleman is my professional and I guess spiritual, psychic, you know, whatever mentor, personal mentor. And he's a family member. And it was interesting. He came to visit in the spring of 79, 9 months prior to this significant event for me. And while he was visiting, he was seemed to be very much interested in me. And I mean, you know, just, you know, talking to me, you know, just at making small talk and, you know, just harmless small talk kind of stuff. But he seemed to be interested in me. And then in subsequent years, he made it very clear that he was interested in me and my skills and abilities and potential. And, of course, I went on to the career that I've had under his direction. So, and he is a man who is far more knowledgeable than about these things than I would say either one of us. So I do see something interesting there in that he visited before and then subsequently I have this happen. And since then, you mentioned, you know, was there something unlocked? I believe that that is one of the possibilities, that something most definitely was unlocked, because there's been some other things he's had me do that are along the natures, in the nature of unlocking parts of the subconscious and memory and understanding and levels of awareness. So that could very well be it. I've even been told, suggested that it was that I am one of these walk-ins. I would say that's on the. That's on the far end of the spectrum of believability, but
I would say so too. I don't know what to make of walk-ins. I've never met one. I have met people who say they are star children. I have met indigo children. I've met two in particular. One, quite recently, is a 12-year-old who is the son of a new friend of mine and his wife. I went over to their house and had dinner. And evidently, this 12-year-old doesn't take to strangers very often. But at the end of the evening, we're finishing up some pie, and he says to his dad, "Dad, I like Dr. Agnew. He reminds me of me when I was his age."
That's a very interesting statement.
Yeah, he is an amazing young man and has such insights, because we were actually talking about UFOs that night, and he had a familiarity with them that was startling and personal. So I'm going to ask you, have you ever had a UFO experience in your life?
The classic UFO experience, consciously, none that I am aware of. I did see, I believe, the F-117 stealth fighter flying around the Southern California desert before it was made public. but I have seen some things that the government has out at certain sites. Like there, for instance, there is essentially a flying saucer that works at Ground Zero out in the Nevada test site, and it's a drone and it's a flying saucer, and they fly it out there and it gets samples and they bring it back to test those samples. So in that sense, but a classic, what's interesting is some people would say I've been abducted. My immediate reaction is no, I have not been abducted for some reason.
Yeah, nothing against your will. Yeah.
Right. It doesn't feel like something was done against my will. And for some reason, I reject that hypothesis. Now, it could be argued that that's why I reject it, because that was put in my mind to reject it. But I want to throw something else out. I said that I would have, placed the walk-in concept at the end of the spectrum of believability if it weren't. I said, but that's because if it weren't for some things that I have learned about something that I believe goes much more to explain what people are thinking is an extraterrestrial experience, and that is interdimensional travel. Specifically, time. Most people think of a concept of a walk-in as another soul. And I thought about this. In fact, when I first heard the concept, I thought, my gosh, for years I've been trying to explain what happened to me. And that comes the closest, when it was explained to me that, my soul walked into this body. And I thought for a time that what happened was the soul born in this body, it checked out. It was time for it to go. But so then my soul walked in on that night, and that's why, I'm like, these are not my hands, was the first thought. Maybe it was just, it was just a whole new body for me. However, I learned some things over the years. I have these conversations with my mentor, I'm going to have to tell you there's some things we talk about that I'm not going to talk about publicly. But, I can tell you, bits and pieces. And we had a conversation once when I was, after I had studied the whole, sat down and really looked closely at the UFO phenomena again, as I had done two or three times. And I was beginning to understand some things, and a thought occurred to me. I asked him, I said, I'm thinking this UFO thing is less extraterrestrial in outer space than it is interdimensional. And, I asked him, what do you think about, am I on, the wrong path, the wrong track if I consider time travel? And it was one of those where it's like, come on, let's go for a walk. And whenever we'd go for walks, that's usually when I'd hear some of the most amazing things. And the
right.
comment I got was, on the walk was, okay, time travel. They've been doing it since the turn of the century, meaning the 1800s into the 1900s, the 19th into the 20th century. That was the statement. Now, what's interesting about that in relation to what we're talking about, in my experience, is when I put it together with a conversation that I had with a gentleman who I met through Greg Bishop, a very intelligent guy, who... I call it the zero line, and it's really more complicated than I'm capable of going into right here and now, but essentially there is reality and time, and truest reality is at the zero point, and it's like a number line. You've got a zero point, and you've got one side of it the line's extending, and on the other side of the zero the line's extending.
Right. And the zero line is the present.
Yeah, and what it is they are both real at the same time, both lines extending from the zero, okay, but in different dimensions, all right? Now, we were talking about some souls, some people, being able to make trips to the zero and back. And, of course, by doing that, you in a very quick way experience everything that's on that line getting there, and then you come back. So you get yanked back, or you zip back, or you choose to go back for whatever reason and plug back into the body, and, in a sense, re-experience it all, thus explaining deja vu experiences, perhaps. Now, when I coupled that with what I was told by a man with, who retired with 44 years in the intelligence profession, that we had been doing time travel since the late 19th century, and I put together all the factors of Nikola Tesla's research and all the things that have been going on, and much of it suppressed, it made a lot of sense to me that perhaps I had made that trip to the zero line and back. I had seen, I had, in a sense, in a flash sense, I had experienced, much like a burst transmitter, if you know what that is, I had experienced my entire life in a burst and was brought back, which explains sometimes when you say you have a feeling of being an old soul. Now, believe me, I believe in reincarnation, and I know how old soul relates to that. But in this sense, if you had zipped forward to the zero line and yanked back, and you had done it at 16, and let's say you lived to be 80 in this lifetime, you're experiencing 60, you know, 70-some-odd years in a flash, and you come back, you're going to feel these old soul perceptions. You're going to feel like a, you know, almost kind of like an 80-year-old man back in your 16-year-old body, in a sense. And, you know, hey, what a dream that is for people. That there, that concept of the interdimensional and the time travel has gone farther to explain, in my mind, what happened to me. Now, I'm a great one who believes in intuition. Human beings have intuition. The female is usually more credited with the intuitive powers, not so much the male. Now, I'm a male with, I believe, more intuitive awareness than most males. The interesting thing is about that, what I'm talking about, is that the great alchemists who studied the Hermetic principles and stuff, they begin to understand that dual nature of God or the gods, the male-female aspect, and then the male-female duality of the human psyche. So it makes sense that if you've experienced this and been exposed to this and been enlightened and aware, you are going to develop more, not materially, but more, what's the word, more outwardly, more, you're going to manifest more literally those traditionally feminine aspects of your existence, and intuition is one of them. My intuition, coupled with my knowledge and some things I've been told and the things I've researched and studied, my intuition, out of all the explanations, this is the one that rings truest with my intuitive gut-o-meter, I call it. It just seems to be the right vibe on the whole issue. And when people say abduction, you go, no, that's not it. It's something else. And I've always believed it was something else from the beginning. But after that, vivid, lucid dreaming, let's see, in January of, I want to say a year after my enlightenment experience, in January of 81, I had what remains the most vivid dream I've ever had in my life. And I can close my eyes and I can tell you the details. And within a couple of months, things in that dream started coming true. Now, I threw this at my mentor. I said, hey, what is this? And he flat out said, you were shown so many years of what was coming. And what's really uncanny is, I can't say he's wrong, because over the years, I've found myself in places that I'd never been before, but were in the dream. And it happens, I'll turn a corner and I'm shocked. It takes my breath away. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And he told me that, you know, he did tell me it's going to happen again in my lifetime, that I would be shown so many years. And
when this happens, when you have this realization, oops, hey, this color or this sound or this place or this person is who I have dreamed about, or where I've dreamed about, or what I've heard or what I smelled, when that happens to you, you have this you said it takes your breath away, but do you sense a purpose? Do you sense that there's a reason why you were shown that one thing?
Yes. It's definitely the personal is involved. It's so that I think what it is it, I look at it as a gift. There have been certain moments in my life since I had the enlightenment experience in the dream where I've just sensed, for instance, be in a place I'm like, okay, I shouldn't be here, or I shouldn't go there, or okay, this is the move I need to make now. Something's telling me. And I do believe it's because for all that I can remember about that first transmission of time, I absolutely there's things in my subconscious that I can't consciously remember, but it comes to me when I hit the crossroads. In other words, you know, I could continue on a path, and maybe when I received that burst, I saw where, yikes, I don't want to do that, or I want to go this way, or I want to be with that person, you know, or I want to do this thing, or maybe I don't. And what I'm doing is I'm getting the benefit that, you know, the classic benefit, you know, well, if I could do this differently.
I was going to ask, do you feel like you're leading yourself somewhere since you had this I'm going to call it a trans-dimensional experience,
uh-huh,
where you disconnected from the three-dimensional timeline and you accessed maybe a fourth or fifth-dimensional timeline for a moment. And although you're a three-dimensional body and you sense your world with three-dimensional sensory perception, you are a multi-dimensional being. And
yes,
although you may have forgotten how to interpret those feelings, they come nonetheless.
Sure.
I'm asking, do you feel like you're leading yourself somewhere, or
yep,
that perhaps there's a friend who has captured some memories for you or some future ideas for you and has delivered them to you for your benefit?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you really want me to say what I have believed for years, what I've known, I'm going to say I've known this on a gut level. It's like this. This place is not my home. My home is somewhere else, far away, and I am here for a purpose. I've known since the mid-80s, because I've seen visions of this, something cataclysmic, and I have a responsibility for a certain number of people to get them to safety from point A to point B.
Yep, I know that dream exactly.
And I assume that once that happens, the purpose is done, and I'm guess I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I die after that. It's an interesting concept. But I also feel other purposes too. For instance, what I'm doing with my publishing company, to a degree, is a personal calling. You know,
sure,
what I write about and what I try to convey in that. But as far as, you know, a purpose, you know, I'd be lying if I said, oh, no, not at all. You know, and at the risk of, you know, sounding like someone that others, you know, call nutty or whatever, yeah, I too am one of those people that, you know, there's a reason. But for me, it's a real nuts and bolts practical thing. It's very much all the things, you know, some of the things I learned in the military, because I've, as an agent for the Air Force, I'm an Air Force officer. I'm not on active duty, but I still, you know, hold my commission. You know, you pick up things, and I believe everything on that path is going to come to serve that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there, and I don't think about it all the time. I've asked certain things, and I've been told certain things that jibe with some stuff relating to 2012 and all that. It depends on, you know, the individual, whether they want to believe that or not. It has led me to, I have been convinced of certain things about the nature of the planet, the geophysical nature of it not being what we're taught. You can relate to that. And but the nature of time, you know, is tied in with all of this.
Well, you know, I'm amazed. It seems like puzzle pieces as I, you know, I started out as a commercial engineer, commercial scientist, and I'm writing technical papers and solving problems and filing patents, and I think I'm doing great things. You know, I'm building cars, or I'm designing polymers, or, you know, solving statistical problems for the medical industry, and I think I'm accomplishing things. And then, you know, I get talked into co-authoring this book, providing the physics end of an archaeological book, which I really didn't think was going to go anywhere. I just enjoyed writing it and had a great time with my co-author, and the darn thing became a national bestseller, and because of that, it kind of thrust me into the limelight, and I got on the radio a few times, and somebody came to me and said, hey, how would you like to have your own radio program? And I thought about it, but, you know, I'm a scientist and an engineer, not really a radio personality. And here we are 2 years later, and I have some 12 million people a week that tune in to this program, and they sit and listen. It's a very eclectic audience, and I get tons of mail, and like you, I feel like, man, I'm on purpose now. I'm doing what I was born to do, and you know, I get notions every now and then because it doesn't really provide a living or anything. It's more of a hobby, of quitting, of saying, you know, I've got 100 hours or so, 150 hours of archive there. That'll last people surely for a while. And then people start writing me, and, you know, don't you dare, because you're going to have Walter Bosley on the program. And then I, like you, have these flashes, these experiences that say, you know, you're preparing people, you're helping people. And then we put together this workshop, which we're going to do in June in Mount Shasta. And it's my first workshop, and frankly, I'm a little scared. Although I've done multi-day trainings in the sciences, this is certainly well beyond my normal genre. But I feel wonderful when I'm doing it. I feel alive, and I feel like this is what I dreamed about when I was 8 years old. That experience that you had when you were 16, I had the summer of my eighth year. Mm-hmm. And then at 51, I have it again, only this time the download is really intense, really intense. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it just filled me so full of stuff, drawings and schematics and sounds and words, a new language, all kinds of amazing stuff. Right. And then I get home and find out the expedition leaders died, and they need a new leader, and now they've elected me to be the leader of this expedition. So, and you're right, it does mean a lot to me, 2012, and the nature of the Earth, this North Pole Inner Earth expedition is, I thought at one time was professional suicide, but I have found millions of people, literally millions of people all over the world, and all kinds of traditions have this idea that if the Earth isn't actually physically hollow, that there may be a fourth or fifth dimensional aspect to it, much as there is to the human body, to the human soul, and that the Earth might in fact be alive, and it might in fact in some sense be hollow. So, right. Gosh, all this begins to tie in.
I guess I'm pretty close to what you'd call a believer. For those who have listened to me on Greg Bishop's show and on a couple other ones I've been on, I'm the sometimes co-host with Greg. That's why I mention his show a lot. But on some of the other programs I've been on, I talk about what I've learned about who and what's under our feet. I have learned that Roswell had more to do with a civilization down below than it ever did with anyone from outer space, and I'm involved very much in investigating the issues of the tunnels and the hollow earth. So, you know, you're preaching to the choir when you talk about that, because I have seen and been told some pretty convincing things about that, and that's kind of my thing. And I want to say that, you know, the whole issue of, you know, they say, well, what's your purpose? I know that something's going to happen, and I know that I'm supposed to help a certain number of people. That's not my end-all, be-all. I just know that that's going to happen, and I know I'm going to do that, and I know basically how to go about it. But what I think about, the thing that really drives me to get into all this stuff, is just, I want to consciously know, I want to see the truth, I want to go to places, and if the earth is hollow, let's rock and roll, let's go see that it's hollow. If it's then we know, you know. But all
You're officially invited to join the expedition. We need you on the ship. We have 103 spaces, actually, and we have 33 that we have chosen, and the rest are sort of up for grabs, and we're picking and choosing. And we want to put together the 100 of the best and brightest and most highest conscious minds we can, and we might just see icebergs and whales, but we're going to shoot 5 documentaries while we're on this 13-day sea voyage on a Russian nuclear-powered icebreaker. And we're going to go to some place that no one has ever gone, no civilians ever gone before, and we're going to look at it in a way that's never been looked at before. And this is a brand new planet we're going to. And if we have the right consciousness and these curious, specially prepared folk with us, we just might fulfill a prophecies of more than one civilization on our planet.
Or at least see what's behind it all.
Yeah, we're just going to go and see. I'm not saying anything is there or not there, but we're going to go and see. And
Well, I'm all for that. I'm a great believer in, you know, you can only sit and read about something for so long, yet you've got to eventually get out there. That's why I and my little group, we've been doing some little investigations in Death Valley. And you know, we're kind of starting locally. Ultimately, I'm going to explore a tunnel with David Childress in South America that the Brazilian Army sent a patrol in, and they explored. They marched but they walked 4 days deep into the earth in a man-made ancient tunnel. And at 4 days deep, they came to a larger room with 3 more tunnels going off deeper into the earth. Now, these are man-made.
That's carrying a lot of water and a lot of supplies.
Well, and they had to turn around because they would have run out of supplies before they went. David Childress has been in this tunnel. He's always wanted to go back with a camera crew, so that's our goal. We talked.
Well, I have a crew, and I have a crew at my disposal, and I have my 2 feet, so I extend my invitation, and maybe we'll extend yours.
You guys join us on ours, and we can make these things happen. We'll have some answers, and we'll see if we're allowed to. Still allowed to talk about them.
Well, we'll definitely communicate off the air, and we'll put that together. Right now, we're going to take a break, 6 minutes. My guest is Walter Bosley, and we're going places well beyond your imagination, so hang in there. We'll be back after these messages. Don't go away. This is X Squared Radio. Ancient times, Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of millions of people. Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can with this group. Click on the 14 Magic Days banner at X Squared Radio and join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th. Shalimar Productions was created from a vision to bring to Mount Shasta the masters who are out there on the front lines helping to awaken a sleeping humanity. From July 12th through August 12th, you can watch this dream unfold through 3 great conferences, including workshops. Nikhil Ledwick, William Henry, Sherry Faria, David Carmos, as well as David Icke and others, will offer you their wisdom and experience.
This is just a sample of the life-changing knowledge you can gain by clicking on the Shalimar Productions banner at X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Do you think it's possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrew, called Your Never-Ending Life, will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjets. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
The spice is vital to space travel.
Welcome back to our third hour of X Squared Radio. We're glad you made it back. If your affiliate is not playing all 3 hours of X Squared Radio, be sure to get a hold of us.
Give us the call letters of that station, and we'll take care of the rest, because we want to make sure that you get all 3 hours of X Squared Radio. We're only on 3 hours a week. We're not on every weekday or week evening, because there's plenty of competition out there during the week. Sunday evenings, there's no show like X Squared Radio, so we want you here with us. I also want to touch base with you again on the workshop that's coming up in June in at Mount Shasta. You need to click on the ET conference banner, which will bring up Shalimar Productions, or you can click on the brochure link right below that, and it will give you the full write-up on the workshop that we're going to conduct there. It's a six-hour workshop, may run a little bit long. We'll give you a heck of a nice book with this and a good workshop. It's going to teach you how to time travel with your mind and how to manifest those things that you're trying to manifest in your life, sort of like unlocking The Secret. If you've read the book The Secret, you know what I'm talking about, The Law of Attraction, although the book enjoyed great promotion. Doesn't really give you all the tools that you might need to be able to do that. So we want to make sure to put that in your hands. And if you can't make it to Shasta to see this workshop, we're going to do something very unique. We're going to broadcast the workshop live. And if you go to Shalimar Productions at shalimarproductions.com, you can sign up for this. $19.95. You don't have to spend any gas. You don't have to buy any plane tickets. But you can watch and record the entire workshop and have it. So you can go back over it time and time again. And if you'll get a hold of us, we'll make sure that you get the workbook material to go with it so that you'll have it in your hands. We feel that it's necessary to be able to affect the change that we're trying to do in the universe. So that's two ways that you can access this workshop. Just trying to do every little bit to help to affect the universe. We try to do that on purpose here. My very special guest is Walter Bosley, and he is writing a book. Can you tell us a little bit about the book that's coming out, or if it's just now finished, what's going to the publisher?
It's titled Latitude 33, Key to the Kingdom. Now, Greg Bishop and I have discussed doing more than one book on the Latitude 33 subject topic. This book specifically deals with Disneyland, and we start by telling what I told about my story, my experience with Alfred, and we delve into what we believe Disneyland is or was. I have to say I now believe at this point in time that the device has been made inoperable purposely. But what the device is, was, what it can do, what it did to me, and the evidence in it, in the park, and in the history of the park that would support our theory. The book, you've mentioned earlier, my company, this book is going to be the first nonfiction book my company releases. I'm going to be releasing it as an e-book for a limited time through my website, and then later in the year we're going to go with a printed version. But I believe the information in it's important, and that's why it's going to be, you know, priced really, you know, compared to other books in this genre, you'd say, or whatever, it's going to be a really great price for the electronic book.
What's the website again?
That it'll be available through lostcontinentlibrary.com. I'm looking at sometime in June, you know, having it finished and ready to go and available for sale then in June.
Well, we got on the radio just in time then. You might notice internet radio does not really have that big of a live audience because of bandwidth. We can only get so many servers on, and we get sometimes 100,000 people listening live. But the archives are hit about 1,500 times an hour starting Monday morning.
Yes.
People come in, they go to work, they buy the archive access, which is about $20 a year. It's really inexpensive at X Squared Radio. And they click on the first, second, or third hour, and they sit there at work while they're working on their favorite project, and they listen. And, man, dude, it really makes a big difference. Most people that come on here say sometime around Tuesday or Wednesday of the week, they see a whole bunch of orders come in. And it's a little bit different operation than just AM radio out there. We don't have 20 million people listening at one time. It's more spread out over time. It's a little different listener, too. Our listener's not driving down the highway in a traffic jam, you know, trying to scratch notes out on a McDonald's napkin.
Right.
They're actually sitting at their PC with their debit card in their hands when they're listening to this program. So it becomes a very powerful tool, which we are at the cutting edge of.
Absolutely. It's really incredible that, you know, so many more people are able to get out there and talk about, you know, that particularly these things, because the mainstream certainly won't focus on it. And when they do, it's usually purely for entertainment and always at the expense of the people who have experienced these things.
Yeah, I know that. But you have a friend here. It's kind of a sanctuary for people who have had these experiences. And there are a lot of us out there who have had them but don't speak about them just for that reason. There are sort of... you know, entertainment because we get to be ridiculed. But when you come here, you've got a friend. And we try to make the results always positive here. We never attack the guests, even if they're way off base. We just try to get them to tell their whole story because our listeners are very intelligent and they want everything that the guest can put out. And they'll make up their minds whether the guest is full of it or not. And of course I try to have the best people on because I'm only on 3 hours a week, so I can be really discriminating.
Sure.
And that being said, we're in the final hour, so I want to make sure to announce the phone numbers that you can call in. Now, our lines have been open the whole show, but some people don't go to the websites where the phone numbers are listed. So here they are. Toll free anywhere in the U.S. 877-876-5227. That's toll-free inside the United States. 877-876-5227. Now, if you live in Canada, we don't leave you out. You can also call in, but the line is not toll-free. In fact, you can call if you're in Europe, if you're on planet or off planet. If you can get to a tower, you can reach us with this number. 530-876-3222. It won't take that long to call in and ask your question, even though you're paying for it. That's going to be your contribution to the program tonight. So those are the two numbers. Again, that last one is 530-876-3222. And we have live people in the studio to answer the phone and put you right on the program. We won't screen you. So you can call in and say anything you want to say. This is Internet Radio.
Brooks? Brooks, can you hear me?
I'm there. This is my producer, Don. How are you, Don?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Dr. Agnew. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we do have a new Canadian number for the both schedules, although it will not be active until tomorrow morning. But they are listed on the website. We will have Canadian numbers, and you will have, we can also bring international numbers as well, and I'll talk with you more about that later. But we will have the Canadian numbers up tomorrow morning and active.
Well, great, great. Thank you very much for the announcement. So next week we'll have a full gamut of phone numbers for the planet Earth. And I greatly appreciate my producer, Don, always coming in and giving us the best and latest. BBS Radio is definitely the number one internet radio network of its kind. We've been with them since the early days, and we've been expanding with them ever since. and whatever they do, we benefit from, and we try to give the best content that we can to the network. So we appreciate them. Now, Walter, I was going to ask you a question. In your interviews for the book, and maybe in your own explorations, have you run across the incident we call a lost time incident, where people are just driving down the highway, eating cookies and drinking milk, and all of a sudden 5 hours turns up missing?
In relation to Disneyland or Latitude 33 in general?
Well, yeah, in relation to Latitude 33 in general or Disneyland or in your interviews to put together evidence for the book.
Well, again, since the book focuses on Disneyland, not specifically for this book, however, the missing time phenomenon is something that does occur, yes, in the zone between 30 and 40, and specifically at 33. But that material that I'm aware of, I've found in other works, other authors' works, that's out there and has been talked about in other books.
Uh-huh.
And we will likely pursue that subject when we write the other book, the general Latitude 33 book, the one that expands on the whole thing beyond Disneyland. We decided to go with the Disneyland one first because obviously it deals with a smaller place on the map. It deals with a place people are familiar with, and it dealt with the personal experience of one of us, myself. I would like to take the opportunity to address the issue of the mouse, and that's what people affectionately call the corporate machine that is Disney. I want to say here that my experiences there and all the stuff that we're writing in the book are not intended to be anything. We're not making a negative statement on Disney or Disneyland here. In fact, I see the fact that this might have been engineered as a very positive thing. I see this as an incredible, amazing thing, if I'm right, if we're right about this, that they could have done. The only people that might be spooked off are, you know, quite frankly, the moms of the little kids that don't want to scare their little kiddies with the idea that there might be doppelgangers and ghosts and things like that running around Disneyland. You know, millions of people go through that park annually and don't have anything like this experience, and I venture to say
right,
particularly since the device has been dismantled. So, you know, this is not intended to be a negative thing. That said, what's interesting about this is, in the last 5 to 10 years, there have been what you call exposés about the Disney parks written and published and distributed in the major bookstores. But yet, I spoke with an agent who shall remain nameless, communicated with an agent who specializes in books on the themes and topics that, you know, you talk about on your show and several others do. And a comment I have from her was, I don't doubt that there'd be people who'd buy the book, but I would never get it past the editors in New York.
Yeah, I had my my own run-ins with the publishers in New York. We finally ended up going with one in Bloomington, Indiana. And that beep usually means we have a caller on the line. So, caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
If it's me, it's Ann, and I'm from Northern California.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. I've talked to you before. I had an experience with someone from the subterranean city for several years, so I'm kind of interested in your trip to the inner earth, and I don't know how to get about doing it.
You'd have to go to the website phoenixsciencefoundation.org and then click on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition link, and there is an application there to fill out.
Oh, okay.
It's not that hard to do. Several hundred people have been vying for remaining 67 seats.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I've talked to you before, and I would love to meet you. So anyway, I might try to in Shasta or something.
Well, I'll be out there in California June 9th through the 11th at Mount Shasta.
Uh-huh.
And then in Trout Lake, Washington, July 5th through the 9th, and then back down in Shasta until the 16th of July.
Wow.
And then I'll be in San Francisco.
Yeah.
For the UFO convention, which is in August 25th.
Oh, really? Well, I might
so
be able to do that
three
one.
Times, four times I'm going to be in California.
Okay.
So you can catch me at any one of those.
Yeah, well, it sounds wonderful. I might be able to do the UFO thing. That sounds good. It's only 3 hours away.
Oh, well, yeah. That's the granddaddy of them all. That's
yeah,
the biggest
I've been
UFO
to,
convention
I've been
in the country.
To Laughlin. You know, to the UFO conference there. It was really good. Anyway, thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks, Ann.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
All right, so you have talked to an agent who says that you can't get a book past the editors in New York, and usually it means that the editors in New York are making up their own minds what they're going to publish or not publish, not
mm-hmm.
that it has an audience or not.
And what's interesting is the agent herself recognized, yeah, this book very probably does have an audience. And so I question in my mind, because I'm analytical like that, it's like, if it's all about business, if it's truly all about business, the dollar, the bottom line, and we have something that will likely have readers, what else could possibly discourage them? Number one, the obvious is fear of the mouse. I mean, ooh, here's a book about Disneyland that's not a tour guide, you know, book that, yikes, we're afraid of, you know, we'll get sued. But yet, I argue against that because of these other books that have been published that are exposés about, you know, employee conduct and things like that. So I would tend to disagree that it's a fear of retribution of the mouse by saying something that might be derogatory, because with my book, there's really nothing derogatory about it. Admittedly, a fundamentalist Christian or fundamentalist whatever religion might, you know, tell me, oh, no, this is all, it's all dark, it's all bad. That's, I don't even want to get into that.
Might have a problem with fairies or gnomes or elves or dwarves anyway, or
yeah.
talking elephants, or for that matter, talking mice. And so
exactly,
if they
exactly.
have that attitude, they don't need to go to the park in the first
yeah.
place.
But I could see Disney as a corporation, you know, oh, you're scaring off the kiddies, blah, 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 we don't like this. However, it just begs the question, you know, if I tapped into something here that is on some, you never know. You know, we always imagine, is there some hidden list of things that are taboo that they'll just be like, no? Or is it, you know, is it part of a, well, we don't want people to think about these subjects in that way. We want people to think about these subjects in this way, so we ain't publishing that. But whatever the reason, I found it to be a really interesting thing. And since I'm a publisher myself, I thought, well, the obvious route for me to take to get this thing out there as soon as possible is to go ahead and do it through my own company.
Yeah, because I can tell you, a publisher who really is thinking about business, they're going to do fine. The publishers in New York, and I have been through a long list. I have a file full of turned-down letters, and I'm not saying this in a vindictive manner at all. It's virtually the experience of every single author, and I've spoken to thousands of them, thousands of them. The New York publishers are no more concerned with the success of an author's book than they are the price of tea in China. They have an agenda, and there is no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Right.
So if you want your book published in a meaningful way, that is to say, have it put on bookshelves and have it put in Amazon or Barnes & Noble and really be empowered to do your own marketing, which you're going to have to do anyway, even if you sign up with a big publisher.
Oh, yeah.
Then publish it yourself. Believe in yourself, and you will be successful.
Yes. Yes, and you know, and one of the reasons I started my company was because there I was, a guy in my late 30s. I've been writing all my life, and I decided, you know what, I have the means now. I'm not going to wait for someone else to publish my books. And there's other people out there like me that will never get the opportunity. So I started my company. It's small press, but It is not, contrary to what one journalist, I'll be polite and call him, said to me over the phone once, that it is not a vanity press like I was accused of. And I use the word accused because that's how it comes off their tongue is, you know, oh, do the I had this guy, this reporter from the Sacramento Bee, if he's listening, he knows who he is and what he is. He asked me in a very, very, I don't know what kind of tone you'd describe it, but do the authors pay me?
Condescending.
Yes, and I explained to him that no, that wasn't the case. So I don't run a vanity press. I decided the obvious thing to do was, well, you know, I have done fiction, but what the hell? If I'm going to have this much difficulty with one of the bigger publishers, I got my own company, fine, I'll keep all the profits myself. You know, and I'll do it justice. You know, I'll make sure it's that nothing's cut out of there that somebody, you know, doesn't want in there. But the important thing is what I, you know, this experience that I've had and the device itself and who was involved with, who I believe was involved with engineering it, you know, this is all in the book. It has to do with a man who, the man that, if you recall, I mentioned that the Stanford Research Institute was hired by the Disneys to be involved in the engineering and construction of the park. And the SRI engineer put in charge of it was a man named C.V. Wood. Now, what's interesting is last fall when I was looking into this and I discovered this one reference to C.V. Wood, I discovered that he's kind of persona non grata in just about every official Disney, you know, piece of literature there is in the history of the company. In recent months, there's been a release of a Disney book, I think Disney A to Z or whatever, that has a very small thing about C.V. Wood. He was the engineer in charge of construction and quit working for Disney in such and such year. And the legend is, elsewhere, is that he and Walt had some type of falling out over the fact that Wood was apparently calling himself the man who built Disneyland or something like that, and Walt didn't like that. My thing is, you know, I was an investigator for a while, and I was in counterintelligence, and I'll tell you right now, I am not a believer in perception is reality, and I always believe there's different layers to stories. I think there's probably something more to that story, that's my gut feeling. And, you know, I'm in the middle of digging into that to find out. But the interesting thing is C.V. Wood, when you look into him, he was a man that was very much known to be interested in psychic and other extraordinary phenomena. He wrote a foreword to a book called The Psychic World of Peter Hyksos, released in the 60s or 70s. And he was known to be interested in these things. Now, there you got a guy who was known to be interested in it, and he comes from an organization that's involved with some pretty esoteric sciences, in some people's opinion, and involved with something less esoteric that has to do with, you know, magnetic energies that, you know, in the magnetosphere of the Earth itself, which would tie in with ley line and ley line phenomena. So you got all these factors. Who really was C.V. Wood? And that's the book. We're delving into that. But I believe that C.V. Wood was the one who created this device I'm talking about. And the device works through the carousel. The carousel itself serves as a spinning motor, as it were. It was placed in a specific spot originally. And let me go back so you understand the importance of the placement of the carousel. And the book gets into this deeper.
It's interesting that it turns clockwise, too.
Yes. Now, here's the interesting thing I discovered when I first started working on the book. I looked into ley lines, and I found that, indeed, Sechery pointed out to me that there are indeed three what are considered ley lines, energy mass concentrations or mass guns, that run through Southern California. And they intersect on the Disneyland property.
Now, that's fascinating. Now, how did they locate ley lines in the 60s when they started building Disneyland? Did they do it by satellite?
In the 50s, I don't know SRI's specific method, but I do believe, because it's not talked about, see, I do believe that SRI was aware of this prior to, because now when you get into these ley lines and things that are built along them, you're going back more decades. You're going back decades before Disneyland was built, and that's a subject.
Oh, sure. I've been to Roslyn Chapel. I mean, that's right on a big epicenter.
Yeah. Now, that's a subject that Sesheri is getting into in his book, The Handprint of Atlas, that's coming out from Adventures Unlimited Press later this year. And he explains it better than I could in there. But SRI already knew this. They already knew about the ley lines. They already knew where they intersected, and they are the ones that said, build the park here. Now, it was their engineer who was hired to be the manager of construction who came armed with the knowledge, and he's the one that designed the layout, the physical layout of the park. C.V. Wood would have been the man who said, put the carousel there on that spot. And
what speed does the carousel turn at?
You know, that's a good question. I'll have that question answered maybe next time I talk with you, or by the time the book goes to print. But that's a good question. It is controlled, of course, nowadays with computers. You know, so that they can get it even more refined. But as I said, I believe the device was dismantled. But when it was originally placed, as most of you have probably guessed, carousel was placed directly atop the spot where the lines intersected.
Of course.
Now, there's a gentleman who wrote a book, and he had done some interesting experiments on his own. And I'm looking through my notes here. I want to find it to tell you about it, just so that I get his name. The book is Needles of Stone by Tom Graves. Okay. Now, in the book, he suggested that circle stones, or circles of stones, have bands of alternating charge, and energy can be derived from the center of that circle and transmitted concentrically outward and stored at the outer perimeter. Now,
Stonehenge.
Yes. This energy can be released, as you desire it, by inserting a small amount of energy into the relevant center stone. Now, he personally did some tests in which he released a pulse of energy that traveled in a straight line for 6 miles to another stone.
Wow.
Okay? Now, Graves, he suggested that the ley lines carry energy of various types, and they plug into patterns of energy at various sites. And he says it's like similar to acupuncture. Now, let's go back to Disneyland. Here you have a park that is, it's not exactly round, okay? It's roundish, but they dug Disneyland down into a bowl. Many people don't realize this, that the railroad goes in a circle on a berm around the park. Now, this was done, superficially to help create more of that you're in another place. You're not in Anaheim, you're in another place, because it's the whole visual thing, the forced perspective. And so, you know, you're down in a bowl, so you can't see what's out and about, you know, surrounding the park. However, I believe that it served the purpose of being the perimeter of the device. Now, where the ley lines intersect is the source of this energy, and they put the carousel on top of it. Now, the carousel, the spinning carousel, serves as the pulsator of that initial little energy, like Mr. Graves talks about, that you put into the center needle stone.
Right.
And then from there, it emanates out, in this case, Disneyland's case, most likely a spiraling band of energy that is stored at the perimeter, which is also the track of the railroad. Now, what does this do? This could possibly create an energy bubble over and throughout the park that is responsible for that magical feeling of being somewhere else when you're at Disneyland. Now, the carousel spins every day, you know, that the park is open, and several times a day, so it's pulsing that energy, or it was pulsing pulsing that energy throughout the park. Now, my theory is that when I went there and rode that carousel that night, the device was still intact and working. And what it can also do, as well as pulse energy out, is naturally being on a ley line, naturally being at the crossroads of three ley lines. There I said crossroads. Remember your fairy lore, what comes and goes at the crossroads interdimensionally. I believe opened some type of, possibly opened a portal. Now let's go back to what I encountered. A man about 70 years old with white hair and a white beard, a black suit, and he was stunned and amazed. Where am I? This place is amazing. Now I want to ask you, go back to the years between 1925 and 1929 when a man also named Alfred with identical white hair and a white beard who was 69 years old, 67 to 69 years old when he was writing his book. There he is on a ley line in England and exploring and investigating these things before he wrote his book. What if he had gone to the intersection of a ley line, and what if he had been transported physically, geophysically, and chronologically to that night in Disneyland in 1980, and thus was amazed? Imagine being a man in England in 1928, and you're transported to Disneyland of 1980, you would think you were in some utopian place. You would be amazed. You would wonder, what the heck? You know, where am I? And obviously, if that was the case, if that is what I encountered, if that is who I encountered, he made it back, because then he wrote his book. Another aspect of my research is to try to determine if there's any clue that Alfred Watkins gave in his writing or anything in his life afterwards that would give a clue or indicate that this might have happened, because they looked identical. They remember, I placed him in 1980 at about 70 years old, and then I learned that Watkins was between 67 and 69 when he wrote the book, when he was investigating the ley lines and wrote the book. So this is the basics of the device. The book goes into, and here's what I discovered the deeper I looked into this, Disneyland, particularly Fantasyland, is just full of hermetic symbolism.
And I'm sure you're going to go into all that in your book, too.
Oh, yes. Well, the carousel itself, you know, there are 12 poles around the carousel. I believe the poles are capacitors. And when the carousel device is spinning, it builds up the energy, or it built up the energy, and at the top of the carousel is a crown. Now, a crown, the crown is one of the four major symbols, alchemical symbols, that have come down, originating in fairy lore. Now, here's what's interesting. I said the device, I believe, is dismantled or made inoperative. In 1982, Fantasyland was redesigned, and part of the redesign, in the redesign, they moved the carousel several feet back from its original position.
So that shuts the device off, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it makes the device inoperable, but what's interesting is about where the center was before, now stands the sword in the stone.
Oh.
I believe it is a key and a lock. But also, you'll find this interesting as an engineer. There is a hedge that is in the little area where the sword and the stone is, and the hedge is between. If you're standing looking at the carousel in front of the sword and the stone, the hedge is between the sword and the stone and the carousel. And this hedge has a zigzag pattern, okay? Two intersecting hedges about 5 inches tall. They intersect in sharp zigzags that kind of form diamond shapes, all right? They look like, it was pointed out to me, that they look like they could be Masonic squares and compasses. But I think they may represent waves of energy, okay?
Sort of an embed.
Yeah, and what it is just kind of a sign to anyone who understands, you know, what might be under here. the sword is pointing down to the spot. The hedge maze is, hey, here you can tap into the energy. And, of course, the carousel is the motive device that makes it work. Now, what evidence do I have about this spinning device that can be used as a motive device to create energy and do these amazing mm-hmm. things, particularly interdimensionally? Well, some of you may or may not be familiar with a device known as the bell. Have you heard of it?
The bell, like the one you ring?
Well, the bell is a device that was being developed by German scientists in the 1930s. It is based on a device described in somewhat good detail in the ancient Hindu scriptures in the Mahabharata, and it consists of two bell-shaped pieces. One fits into the other, and a particular formula of mercury is pumped in between the two pieces that fit into each other, because there's just enough of a gap, and then the devices are made to spin in a counter-rotating way. In other words, the inside one spins opposite of the outside one. And with this particular...
I bet that ratio is 21 to 34, too.
It might be. But the mercury inside spreads out. And what they discovered was that this bell... Now, they were developing it as a propulsion device, because this is the device that's described by the ancient Indian scriptures as the engine for their flying machines, their vimanas.
Yeah, the Vevis.
But what the Germans discovered was it also had another effect, and that was on dimension and specifically time, alternate dimensions and time. Now, you could read much more about this in the Hunt for Zero Point by Nick Cook, and also the SS Brotherhood of the Bell by Joseph Farrell. I highly recommend those two books to anyone, to everybody. And also Black of the Reich Sun by Joseph Farrell. I believe that the same principles that are associated with this device called the bell are the principles through which the carousel device worked. And because the results are very, we're finding in the research that the results are very similar to what we're hearing described with this bell device.
Now, what was the name of the second book again? The Bell something?
SS Brotherhood of the Bell. The SS Brotherhood of the Bell by Joseph Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L, and that's from Adventures Unlimited Press. And that has a companion book called Reich of the Black Sun, but the Brotherhood of the Bell really gets into, and both authors, Nick Cook and Joseph Farrell, cite a Polish author who was the first to write about this publicly, Igor Kukowski. Igor Kukowski was the first author to really come out and say, hey, the Germans were working on this thing. This is what they developed, and his research has greatly pushed forward Joseph and Nick's works, but it's the same principle. Now, the interesting thing is, in the 1950s, SRI and C.V. Wood very likely would have been aware of this technology. I believe that Wood applied it to Disneyland as exactly what it appears, you know, that it is for. It was for enlightenment and awareness for those who would qualify.
That is completely fascinating, and we're going to have to do more research on that. I can't believe we've just about blown through 3 hours already, and we just got to the great, we just opened this can, and so you're going to have to come back and talk about it again.
I'd be glad to.
This is absolutely fascinating stuff. It's going to be a fascinating book, and we're definitely going to have a link to it on the website, and of course this will go into the archives tonight, because tomorrow morning millions of X Squared Radio fans are waiting to listen to this, and we want to have it out there for them. Are you speaking anywhere? Do you have any lectures coming up?
Not right yet. I'm right now over the next month. I'm busy, of course, finishing this book, getting it ready to be sold at on the website this summer, and at the same time, we're putting out our first Lost Comet Library is putting out its first magazine. It's we're doing a lot of things electronic these days because you know we're a small outfit and it's cheaper to do, and yet you know everybody as they download archives, you know people are downloading things to read. And so we're doing our first book on adventure entertainment, but classic adventure, you know, like the old movies and the Indiana Jones type stuff. We're going to be featuring, I was very fortunate to get kind of an interview with Fraser Heston, the director-producer son of Charlton Heston, about the movie Secret of the Incas from 1954, which appears to have been the major inspiration for Indiana Jones. We're getting kind of a scoop on that because no one's really written an article like we're going to have. So that's you know one of the things. But we're busy doing
Us help a little bit at X Squared Radio. We have an online store too, and we can definitely put a link there and
Great.
Try to get your ebook exposed to some more people because we're. You know, one of the things we like doing is helping out the authors. We want to make sure the authors get their word out because then they tell other people, hey, I had a great experience at X Squared Radio, and that helps grow our business as well.
Well, and I need to, I'm remiss right now. I'm a little slow in updating our links page, but I have to do that soon, and I'll throw one of your guys up there on our signpost page. I have some others to put on there. So, definitely. So we can just kind of expand our communities and maybe some of your listeners like the old-fashioned adventure. Like I said, we do most of our stuff can be read by most readers. I'm the only one who writes the dark stuff.
So when you say it's not for kids, it doesn't mean that it's adult. It means that the concepts are probably for a higher reader.
Well, no, there's remember, this is adventure fiction. This is meant to be, you know, primarily, you know, you could take it as just entertainment, but certainly there are some higher concepts, of course. I mean, I can't help but put that stuff in there. But, there's alternative histories, and but there's also, you know, some very scary parts in them. There's some very much sensuality. So the whole thing, the whole gamut, when I say for mature readers, not just intellectually mature, but content-wise mature as well. I have a thing. One of the reasons I started the company was, we're not a children's book publisher. There's plenty of those. I tell people if you want something for your 12-year-old, everything but the stuff I write so far, you know, a 12-year-old can read.
R.L. Stein is out there for that reader.
Exactly. But I tell my writers, please, no stories where children are the main characters. Our thing is there's plenty out there in the entertainment world where people who are 20 years old, who, you know, a smart-ass 20-year-old, you know, with a computer and knows everything in the world and the villains are all, you know, white guys over 30. I tell my author, you know, none of that stuff. Hollywood produces enough of that garbage. Our books, have heroes that, you know, might be 45 years old and a little thick in the middle, you know, a little gray hair. Our books don't feature kids as the main characters. What I'm trying to do is, our audience is our adults out there that love fun genre entertainment. But these days, the mainstream, if it's genre entertainment, they're afraid of angering the moms of the 12-year-olds, or they're afraid of losing the 12-year-old or 9-year-old's dollar. Well, you know, that's okay. They're providing that demographic with entertainment. I'm providing another demographic with entertainment.
I got you.
Yeah.
In the last 6 or so minutes of this program, can you tell the story of Eddie and Louise really quick?
Oh, you did read that. Eddie and Louise. Louise was, I've had two mentors in life, mentors on these kind of things, extraordinary things.
And one of them was a woman named Louise, and her and her husband Eddie were neighbors. In my first couple of years of college, lived in an apartment complex, and they were from New York. They were in their 60s then, and they were kind of like surrogate grandparents, you know, kind of, you know, the nice older couple that, you know, would tell me, you know, spooky stories and things like that. And of course, I was very much interested in the stuff because I'd already had my enlightenment experience. And Eddie was really quiet, and Louise was the outgoing one. She's the one that knew about all this stuff, and you know, Eddie was the loyal, quiet husband, you know, taking care of his wife in their retirement. And I knew Eddie had been been in the Air Force. He was an enlisted guy. He was like a medical assistant kind of thing, nurse's aide or whatever, while on active duty. And they're just a nice couple. What I learned. It's kind of hard to tell this one in a few minutes, but roughly, I would learn that Eddie was much more involved in a military career than I had realized, and actually he was the one that knew even more about psychic things than Louise did. In a nutshell, the summer that Eddie passed away, I had gone to a psychic fair with them. And that's when I discovered how much Eddie knew about this stuff. And what's interesting was after he died, about 9 days after he passed away suddenly. Now, Eddie had a heart condition, and he would get his medicine through the VA hospital. Because if you're a veteran, they'll test medicines before they release it to the general public. And as a veteran, you can get your medicine for free as long as you agree to be tested on something. So he was on an experimental heart cardiac medicine. And when he passed away 9 days later, I'm having a weird experience in my house, and the phone rings, and it's Louise. And she tells me that she had just had a – oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm getting it mixed up. I apologize. I'm thinking of another episode. This is what happens when I try to do this in 6 minutes. I called her because I had had this odd experience. I'd gotten in the shower. I was the only one in the house. I have a habit of locking doors, you know, and I felt like someone was in the bathroom. I pulled the shower curtain aside. No one was there, but there was a strange – winding curlicue design drawn in the mirror, in the fog on the mirror, by a finger. Uh-huh. I had cleaned that mirror myself the night before. So I get out there and I call Louise and I say, "Hey, Louise, something weird just happened. Somebody was just here." And she says to me, "Well, I have somebody here too, and it's very strange." And I told her, "I'll be right over." So I get over there and the man is gone, and she tells me that a gentleman, very dusky skin, with dark black glasses, the kind that you wear in the old days when you're sunbathing. They're not meant to be seen through. They're just meant to block the sun from your eyes. Right. He knocks on her door, and he's out looking at apartments, and he said the manager said he could look at hers, and he walks in to the little apartment, looks to the left, looks to the right, in the back where the little rooms are, turns and walks back to the door, and then he looks, and she had her curtains closed, and it was dark in there, and then he looked in the corner and saw a mobile with unicorns. He says, "I see you're into unicorns." She said, "Yeah." He goes, "Are you also interested in UFOs?" And she said, "Well, yes, I am." And then he stepped outside, said, "Thank you." And then he turned to her and he said, "By the way, Edward was a good man." And at that point,
Edward was a good man?
Edward was a good man. He not only knew the name, you know, her husband's dead husband's name, but he seemed to, he spoke as if he knew him personally.
Wow.
This was 9 days after Eddie had died. Okay? Now, the phone rings, and it's me calling her to tell her about a weird visitation experience that I had just encountered. So she hangs up on the phone with me, steps outside, and he's gone. Now, he told her his name was Mr. Grosvenor. I haven't yet to find the significance in that, not for lack of trying. But the interesting thing is, a little while later, I think about another week or so, she calls me and asks me to come over. She says the apartment's been broken into. And I get over there, and she shows me where they broke a window in the bedroom, okay? But first, she points to an envelope of $400 cash that she had on her dresser. Then she points to a brand new TV and VCR, okay? That stuff was not taken. An envelope clearly open with $400 cash. Her money was not taken. She points her jewelry box. Nothing was taken. I asked her, I don't understand, Louise, what was taken? And she brings me into the kitchen, and she opens the cabinet where Eddie had kept his medicine from the VA, and that was what they had taken, was the remaining medicine after he had passed away. Now, that's not all of the story. Then she says, now come here. She takes me into their spare bedroom that they used as storage. She opens a drawer in a chest of drawers, and she goes, I've never seen that stuff in my life. It was about 20-some-odd different styles of pairs of men's eyeglasses and two toupees of just different colors. Okay? And there's more. Then she takes me into their room, opens the closet, and reaches in and shows me a U.S. Air Force issue winter parka with the name tape still on it, U.S. Air Force on one side, and the other one, Major Lundy. Now, Eddie, I'd seen his DD-214. It said Staff Sergeant when he got out. Okay, Major Lundy. The final piece was she shows me a cigar box, and the cigar box she opens up, and again, she says, I've never seen this stuff before today. In that were several bills of different denominations of international currency.
Sounds like a man with a different life, with battle ready to travel, with cash in hand, did not have to make any kind of monetary exchange, and he may have been an agent of some sort for the Air Force or posed as an Air Force officer.
Right.
In any case, extremely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And you and I will be in touch after this program privately, and we'll set something up, but consider yourself invited to the expedition to the North Pole in the summer of 2008.
Oh, I greatly appreciate that. I will do everything I can to make that.
And so we are actually out of time, but I have maybe 30 seconds, so I need to thank you proliferously for being on the program tonight. And, of course, the archive will be made available to you, and we'll give you a logo to put on your website, and everything will be hunky-dory. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this interview. I can't believe another 3 hours has blown by.
Well, thank you for having me. I really do appreciate having the opportunity to tell about
it. Absolutely my pleasure. So have yourself a very productive week, and we will be in touch by email and by telephone.
All righty. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, that is it for another great three-hour program with X Squared Radio. You now know who Walter Bosley is, and you're going to be looking for his book, and it will be at lostcontinentlibrary.com, and we'll have a link to that at the archive at X Squared Radio. Those of you that are only listening live, you may have missed something. You'll want to sign up for that archive. It's $2.50 if you just want to listen for a month, and it's about $20 a year. And we will say good evening to you. And next week, Open Lines with X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.